There were a few questions that were submitted today, so we'll spend some time with those, but I did want to just reflect for a few minutes about the thing that I had thought about reflecting about, and that is clear comprehension. That term, as we've explored, is used in the definition of what wise mindfulness is. It abides observing, the body as a body, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful, having set aside greed and distress for the world. And so it's right in the definition. So it's a kind of a foundational piece of mindfulness. And we've talked a little bit about it. And in my understanding, it's very connected with the wisdom side. It's infusing the practice with wisdom. That definition of clear comprehension that I've expressed, one being discerning thoughts, feelings, perceptions as they arise, persist, and pass away, brings in the perception or the exploration of impermanence there. There's some other explorations or uses of the term in the suttas that give it a flavor of kind of the conscious or deliberate awareness. We know what we're doing while we're doing it. It's kind of got that conscious quality, that deliberate quality in some of the various places the term is used. It also seems to express this discernment around what's skillful and unskillful. That there's not a kind of elaborate teaching on clear comprehension in the suttas. The commentaries, on the other hand, do give a quite elaborate teaching on this term. And I won't do a long riff on that right now, but I was just in reflecting on it, thinking about what could I say in a few minutes about this. The commentaries break the clear comprehension into four kinds, four aspects, we could say, four parts to clear comprehension. Clear comprehension of purpose, of suitability, of domain, and of reality. And as I was thinking about this, I was thinking, you know, it's kind of like clear comprehension of purpose is, I'll try to do each of these in just a sentence or two. And to me, clear comprehension of purpose is kind of that larger purpose, looking at our aspirations and how do we infuse what we do with those aspirations. So the larger purposes that we go through life with, are they in line with the Dharma? And then suitability is looking at our kind of what we do, the actions. It's to me, it kind of like it comes in a little bit. The purpose is speaking to the aspirational aspect of how the Dharma might inform us. And suitability is looking at what we're actually doing and how can the Dharma come into that. So, you know, when whatever we're doing, going grocery shopping or working for our companies or working for ourselves or just taking care of our lives, our ordinary, usual needs, is it framed with the perspective of the Dharma? We can take care of our needs either kind of habitually without thinking much about them or understand that it's supportive of the Dharma for us to be doing this. That was such a huge kind of shift of mind for me at one point when I was still working as a computer programmer. And just felt like it was taking my time away from what I really wanted to be doing, which was the Dharma. And at some point, I recognized, I mean, I was practicing in those places. I definitely was trying to bring mindfulness to what I was doing in those places. So, and that's the aspect of clear comprehension of domain. In whatever we're doing, can we be mindful there? And so I was exploring that, but still there was this kind of like, you know, it's like, this isn't maybe as purposeful as it could be. You know, it's like, if I only had a different kind of job, then I could be expressing the Dharma better or something, you know, something along those lines. But then, you know, in reflecting on it, I realized that the work I was doing there was the whole way that I could be. I mean, it was offering me my livelihood. It was a kind of, in some ways, a kind of a neutral livelihood. It was working as a technical writer for Sony, you know, so it was kind of a neutral livelihood. But that, what the support that it gave me to have a home, to have feed myself, offered me how I could be practicing. And the whole, you know, way in which I managed to construct that livelihood gave me 6 months of the year off. So, you know, it was quite a gift. So at some point I realized, wait a minute, this activity is supporting the Dharma. And that shifted my whole relationship to being at work. And so for me, that was a kind of a little reflection on the suitability of that work. And so to me, like, the purpose is the big, like, the aim, the direction of our life in the direction of the Dharma towards freedom, towards liberation, and then the specifics of our life. How does that purpose inform the specifics of our life? And then the domain is essentially every moment. I mean, we could choose a particular meditation object and say that's our domain for mindfulness. But what we are practicing here is just how every single moment, every single thing is the domain for mindfulness. In some ways, again, kind of a little bit more narrowed in even further. Just every single breath, every reaching, every step, every chopping of a vegetable is an opportunity to bring that practice into life, to orient towards our purpose in this very activity. Shantideva wrote a beautiful poem, book, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life in the, I think, the 8th century. And he had a question for us. How can the practice of mindfulness be performed under these very circumstances? And it's always possible. That, to me, speaks right to domain, the domain of our practice. Every single moment. And then clear comprehension of reality, to me, that is speaking to the understanding that arises. Clear comprehension of reality is explained or explored as awareness, mindfulness, being clear about impermanent, unreliable, not-self nature of phenomena. That's clear comprehension, sometimes expressed of non-delusion. So the mind without delusion. So that's not something so much to practice as it is something to realize. And as I was reflecting on this kind of the large picture of the purpose and then how does it inform our activities and inform just being present in each and every activity, this is what we've been practicing this week. We've been keeping the perspective of the Dharma in mind all week long in our kind of more normal life situations. Some of us have been a little more secluded, a little more stepped back from everyday activities than others. But to some extent, we've all been, as I'm talking with the managers today, she said, that both Doug and Kathy said, it's like we've, you know, everybody's their own service leader here. You know, the service leaders at IRC take care of the managing and, you know, make sure people have the needs they have, and they take care of their meals, and, you know, that's the jobs of the service leader, and we're all our own service leaders here, coming in and out. At the very least, we're doing that for ourselves. And so we're all doing this integration, this back and forth kind of integration. That is one of the big gifts of being a service leader at IRC, that practicing in that place, being immersed in the Dharma and still having to come in and out. And that's what's been happening here. I've heard it in the meetings, the practice meetings. We've been holding the perspective of the Dharma. It's been so like up for us all. It's been infusing what we do, how we do it. We may forget, but it's not very far away. And it's been so inspiring to see the ways in which the wisdom and the Dharma perspective has been incorporated, integrated. As I used this image a little earlier in the group, I had this image at one point of each of us kind of in our own places, tilling our own soil. And however each of us is tilling it, the Dharma is going into that soil and nourishing what grows there. It's been such a pleasure and delight to spend this time with you. And to see the power of the Dharma, the wisdom of the Dharma, how it can seep into whatever soil is being tilled. That, how can the practice of mindfulness be performed under these very circumstances? So, for the sake of the recording, I thought I'd start with the questions that were submitted before, and then at some point we can break the recording and see if there's any questions alive in the room, the many rooms that we're in, and that part of the recording would be just for retreatants only. So a question about mindfulness coming and going. And I talked about that what happens when the mind wanders is that mindfulness has disappeared and then mindfulness returns. So in some ways, we can look around the edges of thinking for a little bit of that understanding of the experience of mindfulness, the experience of awareness itself. The comings and goings of awareness, mindfulness being a conditioned phenomena that comes and goes, not a steady state. And so the question asked, their understanding was that for Bhikkhu and Alio, awareness is always present and we come back to awareness when we wake up when our mind wanders. and also heard teachings that awareness is vast and infinite. And some of this is, as I pointed to when I talked about using the term awareness, some of this is different uses of the term awareness. And so this is why I said it's really helpful to understand, get the definition. When somebody starts talking about awareness, find out what they mean. And so I did say that I'm equating it with mindfulness. And so awareness does come and go. But I also said that I liked using that term because it's more evocative of the state. And, you know, it kind of can shade in a way to different ways that it feels when we are aware. So in terms of Bhikkhu and Alio, I think he uses awareness to mean mindfulness. At least when I just checked in the book again, just briefly, he talked about, you know, in the early sections of the book, he talked about the, mindfulness being a kind of present moment awareness. And in fact, in his, glossary of that book, in the index of that book, under awareness, you know, it has awareness and it lists a few specific references for awareness. And then it also says, see also sati mindfulness. So I feel like he uses awareness and mindfulness pretty synonymously. And I'm pretty sure he wouldn't say that mindfulness is always present. So I think there maybe was in thinking that Bhikkhu and Alio says awareness is always present, that might have been a slight misunderstanding of something he said. Or sometimes I say, sometimes awareness, the word awareness can shade into like a more colloquial use of the word. And so for instance, we could say like I've had the experience of waking up into mindfulness and realizing I had not been mindful in the moments before, but that I realized that I knew what had happened in the moments before. So there was something that was going on there. And Sayadaw Utejaniya explains it by saying, well, the five aggregates are carrying on. You know, whether we're mindful or not, the five aggregates are carrying on. So consciousness, perception, mental formations, feeling, and the body are all carrying on, whether we are mindful or not. And those processes, in particular, consciousness, feeling, perception, have some of the function of remembering what we were doing. And so there's a way in which consciousness, feeling, and perception functioning together gives us a sense that we were aware. Something was aware, and that's using aware in a more colloquial term there. You know, it's more using it in just an everyday use, not in a more specific kind of technical use of awareness as mindfulness. It feels like when I came back, something had been aware, but I hadn't been aware while it was happening. And the thing that the processes at work there that have that kind of continuity going are consciousness, feeling, perception, mental formations. The mental aggregates keep going, whether we are mindful or not. And there's a couple in particular, a consciousness and attention. Those two are said to be present in every mind moment. And Bhikkhu and Alio, there was a sentence in Bhikkhu and Alio's book saying, you know, attention is in the commentary said to be happening in every mind moment. You know, whether we are mindful or not, attention is happening. So attention is that factor that picks something out of experience to pay attention to, which also explains or kind of, you know, that experience when I wasn't mindful but was aware in that kind of more normal way of using that word. Attention was picking things out of the experience. even though I wasn't mindful of it at the time. I wasn't mindful in the moment. But in mindfulness returning, I could remember the things that attention had picked out. I remembered watching, I was sitting in a dining hall at a retreat center, and I remembered watching somebody come in and kind of track their movement through the dining hall. And then somebody else came in and tracked their movement through the dining hall, and then I came back into awareness. And it was kind of, it was interesting at that moment. It was like, wow, what's the difference here? It's like, I remembered all that stuff, but I wasn't really aware at the time. And now I'm aware in the moment. You know, what's the difference there? And I went and reported that to Gil, and he said, the difference is enormous. It makes all the difference to be aware in that moment. And also, you know, the fact of, like, consciousness and attention kind of present apparently in every mind moment. The commentaries and the suttas also talk about these not being permanent. They are conditioned. Consciousness is clearly described as arising conditioned. We talked about that the other day, conditioned on various sense doors, all that tottering we talked about. The eye and forms, eye consciousness arises in dependence on those. So consciousness arises and ceases. Attention arises and ceases. So they're not stable. They're just, they're processes that tumble on. It's been useful for me to recognize or to kind of have this sense of the tumbling on of the aggregates, these five processes tumbling on, and then mindfulness. It's like mindfulness can be, have us be aware of any of those, or even the functioning of them together. So the arising of mindfulness serves to make us aware of how the aggregates are doing their job. Make us aware of consciousness, make us aware of perception, of feeling. A question about the phrase I used the first day, malleability of mind. This question could we elaborate a little bit on that. The things that are arising right now to explore is more kind of the experiential side of it. How it has felt when the mind is not malleable and how it feels when it is malleable. When it's not malleable, and there's many different ways it cannot be malleable. I mean, the clinging essentially kind of creates a rigidity in the mind. We cling to something, we want it to be a specific way. The mind is not very flexible. Malleability, flexibility, different kind of translations of that. And other ways to talk about that. There's a Pali word that's used, I don't know it at this moment. But it is understood as being a part of one of the mental factors that can arise is the malleability of the mind. And when there's clinging in the mind, it's like the malleability is reduced. It's like the mind kind of gets very set or rigid around what is possible, what's not possible. Views and beliefs kind of make a play in that place about non-malleability. Ideas about what should be happening, what shouldn't be happening, again, they kind of create a rigidity in the mind, where the mind can't be so flexible when things aren't that way. We're trying to hold them that way, and then something happens to kind of shake it up, and we go, no, let's try to keep it still. And so the mind, you know, is it that non-malleable mind is not as open to the impermanent changing nature of experience. It wants things to be more stable, to land somewhere, to have something reliable. This also comes into play based on views and perspectives of practice itself, what practice means, what it means to be mindful. I feel like a lot of what we've been exploring this week has been shake up those notions of what it even means to be mindful. Shake up the notions of what has to be arising in order to be mindful. Shake up the idea that if something shifts suddenly, that, you know, that it's going to be a problem to kind of transition to a different kind of experience. I don't remember if I've talked on this retreat about this experience. I know I have on prior retreats, so they get confused in my mind sometimes. For me, there was a kind of an exploration in the practice around malleability of mind and non-malleability of mind related to what I thought were disturbances in the practice. And at one point at IMS, something happened in the meditation hall. Somebody fell, and I was the only other person in the hall, and the person couldn't walk. And so I felt like I went over, I said, do you need some help? I spoke to the person in the meditation hall. It was dark. We couldn't really see each other. This is why the person fell down. And so I went to the staff dining room to get people to help the person who'd fallen down. And I walked into the staff dining room. And the reason it had been dark was because it was Halloween, and there were pumpkins in the meditation hall, and so it was pretty dark in there. And I walked into the staff dining room, and it was a Halloween party. And it was very alive and noisy and active, and I think there were probably at least 40 people in the staff dining room. And I felt like the energy of that just blew me out of the dining room, blew me out of the staff dining room. And fortunately, the night contact, the person who was kind of the person to take care of yogis, had seen that I'd walked in, and he kind of followed me out of the staff dining room and asked me, how can I help you? And I communicated what I needed to communicate. In any case, the mind for the next, I don't know, couple of days was so upset that this had happened, because it had destroyed my concentration. This was my idea, it was my view. It had made it not possible for me to be mindful. I wasn't exactly angry at the person who fell down. I was kind of like maybe a little miffed about the Halloween party happening in the staff dining room. But, you know, it's like, the mind at that point was not very malleable around, well, this was the experience. This is what needed to happen. Wow, that's an interesting thing to be like taken in that energy of the Halloween party. Whoa, that feels different. You know, that wasn't the way my mind was dealing with it. The way it was dealing with it was, okay, I got to get back to that quiet. So this is not malleability. There was an idea that the practice would unfold in that quiet place I was before. It wouldn't unfold here in this place with all of this energy arising. And so the idea was I had to get back to it. And I spent some time watching the mind, kind of reliving that experience, knowing that, and then having the ideas arise, this is a big problem, it's going to take forever for me to settle down. Okay, come back to the breath. Okay, thoughts arise. Why did this have to happen? Much of what was going on there was that the mind was keeping itself whipped up by talking to itself about how much of a problem it was. This I really learned in retrospect a bunch of years later when I went to Shui Yu Min, and we were encouraged to talk, to explore being mindful while speaking. And we would have lively conversations over lunch or during a walk, and I would go back to my room. And I think at least partly because Sayadaw was interested in hearing, so what was your experience like while you were talking? And what happened as it unfolded? You know, so it upped the curiosity for me. That, his interest in that, was a condition that supported malleability for me. And so I got interested in what happened. And the mindfulness came and went while I was talking. It wasn't easy at all. In fact, I would lose mindfulness for whole chunks of lunchtime. Dharma conversations, but still, you know, not very present in the moment with it. And I would go back to my room to sit after the conversation. And what I experienced was a lot of energy in the body. But because of the curiosity of just, well, this is part of the practice too, the mind was much more malleable, much more willing to, that was a condition. Having that conversation was a condition. How is it now? That's more malleability. The mind not hooking to or kind of hooking on a particular perspective and thinking it's supposed to be that way. And actually, at Shui Yu Min, it was quite remarkable to see just how fast the mind could settle when the mind wasn't resisting that energy. Like, oh yeah, wow, whoo, this is a lively experience. Feels like a lot of vibration in the body. Kind of enlivening. And then, you know, just being with it, it's like, I sometimes use the snow globe analogy, to like having, engaging with conversations or doing things. It's like, you know, the snow globe, you pick up a snow globe and you swirl it around and all the little glitter kind of gets swirled into the snow globe. It's like the energy in the system. It's apparent, the energy in the snow globe, because the glitter is riding that energy, those waves of energy. And it's delightful to watch a snow globe. You know, we shake it up so that we can see, watch the glitter, but you put the snow globe down on the shelf and the glitter settles of its own accord. And that's what happened, you know, unless you keep picking the snow globe up, the glitter will settle. And that's what the mind recognized in this particular exploration, was that just being curious about that swirling energy without picking it up and shaking it around and saying, oh, this is a problem, or, oh, I want to keep this to go, keep going. Without either of those, it just swirled and settled and settled and settled. And within a few minutes, the mind was in a pretty quiet place again. The other thing about malleability is it does feel connected in some ways to perspectives or perceptions that we have. We orient around looking at experience in a particular way, sometimes not through choice, but just sometimes our mind is oriented towards seeing things pretty ordinary. Other times, especially as the meditation begins to deepen, as the practice unfolds, sometimes the awareness and wisdom kind of orient to a more kind of particulate moment-to-moment kind of unfolding. This is a perception. Perception of, it's not any more real than the ordinary perspective. It's just another perception of the information coming into the system. It's like the system can almost decide, is it going to orient in a normal way to ordinary experience, or is it going to orient in a more moment-to-moment seeing the nature of experience as impermanent? It's not often that we actually have a choice there, but it is, it can happen, actually. I did have, this is another place where the malleability of mind was revealed in my practice, where I was sitting waiting for an interview, and in that kind of very discreet place of just everything kind of separate little discrete bits of information that felt pretty chaotic and not very pleasant to be in. And I was waiting for a while for the interview, and at some point this kind of thought occurred. It's like, gee, I wonder if I can be normal. And it wasn't something I brought in. It was just a kind of a question, or a question that arose in the mind. And in a split second, everything was completely ordinary. The mind shifted, like the perception shifted in a split second. And that was a little bit of a shock, because prior to that, it's like there'd been a little bit of like orientation to, if I'm in this state, it's like, ooh, it's deep, you know? It's like, it's going to take a long time to come out of this. I'd better be really careful, or, you know, something like that, you know? Like, ooh, I better be careful. I hold on to the wall as I walk down the wall, you know? But in that moment, there was just this, like, immediate shift. Completely ordinary. No problem getting up and walking around. And then there was the question, gee, I wonder if I can switch back. And poof, there it was. That experience taught me a lot about the malleability of mind, and how it's a lot of the non-malleability is hooking to a particular perception and assuming it's got the stability. Assuming it's got some kind of stability. And we don't always have the choice there, because the habit of mind is to stabilize our perceptions so that we can like walk around the world. But this this malleability of mind, this ability for the mind to be in a very quiet, still place and then come out and be in an ordinary place, that I feel like is some of what you've all been getting to explore in these 10 days. Because being that your own service leader, we have to do that kind of shifting and not resist it and not hold on to that, you know, whatever place we were in a sitting meditation, or it's like, oh, it's time to make lunch. Okay, that's what has to happen right now. So that kind of malleability, it begins to kind of like break down the ways in which we hold on to, you know, clinging to pleasant states or holding on to things we think should be a particular way. And one more question. I'll try to just do this one briefly. There's a lot. This one could unpack a lot, too. This one could probably be a whole Dharma talk. But I do want to see if there's questions in the room too. So essentially, it's a question about seeing beliefs and how beliefs operate, recognizing how the mind functions when they're present, what happens when they go away, and how the mind doesn't have to have beliefs operating that are kind of habitual. So it's in that terrain of exploring beliefs. And then the question that comes is like from the talk this morning, the reflection this morning around what's arising is just here and now. The question of when those beliefs aren't consciously or actively in awareness, do they exist? How does it say? Does this mean that the long-standing core beliefs and views actually do not exist when they're not actively in awareness? The experience is one of their operating under the surface, even when they are out of awareness. Are these beliefs and views newly recreated each time they arise? What I would say is that, yeah, unpacking this is like, it's a lot to unpack this whole thing, but I hope to say something like useful here. What's arising in the moment, the here and now, it's not independent of conditions. We're shaped by past choices, shaped by views and beliefs that have been operating, and in a way we could say that those views and beliefs are carried in the momentum of the direction of how we've been shaped. It's like karma has a momentum. It's like karma is like an energy that tends to propel us in a certain direction. And so those views and beliefs are kind of like, we can think, I sometimes use this analogy of karma, like if there's a really windy day, you know, if it's a really windy day and you're trying to kick a soccer ball or a really light ball, you know, if you kick the ball, it's going to be carried by the wind to some extent. So the condition of the wind, that momentum or that direction of the wind, is going to affect what happens when you kick the ball. And it's like karma's got that kind of wind, you know, it's like the momentum of our choices inclines the mind in particular directions. And there's a phrase or a term that's used, the Buddha used, the suttas use this phrase, underlying tendencies. Now, these tendencies may not be active in the moment, but it's kind of like that momentum or the habitual shape direction of our minds. That has a it's maybe kind of like the wind blowing in a particular direction. And so, you know, kicking a ball, if you kick it against the wind, well, maybe it goes against the wind a little while, but eventually it's going to kind of be taken by the wind. It's like that momentum, that underlying tendency tends to kind of propel the mind in that direction. And so perhaps views and beliefs kind of are in that terrain of underlying tendencies. They may not be active in the moment. So for instance, here's another way to look at this. So aversion may not be arising in the moment. And when aversion is not arising in the moment, you know, aversion is not there. But that doesn't mean necessarily that the tendency towards aversion, it's like it doesn't take much for that tendency to kind of come back. And so I think that's the feeling of it kind of hovering under the surface, the sense that it doesn't take much to kind of have that tendency arise again. One way that I think about these underlying tendencies, and this is a modern way, it's a more scientific way of thinking about these underlying tendencies, is to think about how the brain works. You know, we have, you know, when we do something a lot, and then the Buddha says, whatever we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of the mind. So we frequently ponder something, and that creates those underlying tendencies. It becomes the inclination of the mind because it's been practiced so much. So you get close to something and it like, oh yeah, that's a comfortable place. It kind of slips into that kind of familiar thing. In the brain, apparently, I mean, I know this only in the most general of ways. What we do a lot with our minds, it's kind of like, it creates what might seem, what are kind of like these patterns in the neurons. And when there's a particular pattern that's engaged in, when it's repeatedly engaged in, it seems to be the kind of the mechanism of the way the mind works, the brain works. It's like, oh, that one's important. Let's add some more neurons to that pattern. And so, you know, when we engage in the pattern, the more we engage in the pattern, the more that pattern gets kind of shored up. And in my experience with particular patterns around aversion, it's like it's so shored up that it's like any neuron firing pretty much anywhere can find its way into that pattern. And yet, when that pattern is not like being lit up, you know, when it's not engaged, it's not active. It's still got the possibility to be active, but it's not actively producing its results, kind of sitting there quiet or something. It's still got the possibility to produce that. But the cool thing about the brain is that apparently when we don't engage in a particular pattern, those things that went and shored up that pattern, it's like, when a pattern isn't engaged in, apparently it's like those neurons kind of find other things to do. They break the connections to that pattern. When I heard that, kind of heard that kind of description of that's part of the plasticity, we could say malleability of the way the brain works, and that's part of the plasticity of the brain, that it doesn't just make connections and they stay static. The connections can weaken if they're not found to be useful. If they're not used so much, the neurons seem to know, this one's not being used, let's go elsewhere. When I heard that description, I think it was in that, it was in some movie, what the F is going on or something like that. Something like that. I thought, oh, that's the fetters breaking. You know, it's like when we don't actively engage in a pattern, it's like that's the weakening of the fetters. It's the weakening that it's a kind of a physical mental correlate of how the letting go of habits and patterns can happen. And yet, I have experienced You know, that to me is kind of like the rotting rope, the wearing away, that kind of gradual wearing away, because as I understand it, that doesn't happen very, very suddenly. But the Dharma does have a way to transform those patterns in a split second, and I don't know what's going on in the brain there. That there's a way, sometimes certain understandings can arise in a split second that can just kind of, it's like it just cuts the ground out from under that pattern. So there is also that possibility that some insights can weaken those patterns so quickly that they don't arise anymore. So that's probably enough for that question right now.